Well, first up now, the deeper issues involved in this question of who has the right to insist that someone get a COVID vaccination or, well, or not work in a particular area or gather or fraternise. As you'll know, these are no longer theoretical issues. This week, Qantas joined the Shepparton Fruit Processor SPC and the Alliance Aviation Company in leading the way for businesses demanding that employees get the jab if they want to continue working. Bluntly put, typically by Alan Joyce, if you've got no medical reason to refuse, maybe you should leave the aviation industry. Now, a lot of us might agree. A lot of us might be unsure. The federal government certainly seems unsure, declining to offer employers legal cover. Others remind us there are quite solemn ethical considerations underpinning these decisions, which go to the core of many of our rights in liberal democracies, and these may need refreshing. So there's no time like the present to canvass these nuanced arguments about individuality and common interest and so on. And I'm glad that Senior Counsel and National Criminal Justice Spokesman for the Australian Lawyers Alliance, Greg Barnes, could join us. His recent article on the site Pearls and Irritations prompted me to think about this more than I'd planned. He was a bit wary of these moves, he said. Dr. Simon Longstaff's also joining us, who loves a chance to ventilate such matters. Executive Director of the Ethics Centre and well-known to listeners. Well, welcome to you both.
Thanks, Geraldine. Thanks.
Could we focus on this word mandatory, please? The World Health Organization says there's no such thing as a mandatory vaccination in the contemporary sense in which it's being discussed. By that, they mean, Simon, it's not truly compulsory. Rather, people are compelled to get vaccinated via direct or indirect threats. Now, can you help us understand the distinctions, please?
Yeah, there are three different types of requirement that can be put on people. One is a genuinely compulsory requirement where there is no exception and if you fail to comply, you're subject to punishment. And there are very few of those sorts of things in Australia, but we might typically think of something like where you, for example, have to turn up at a voting place if you're on the electoral roll to vote. And there are a few others. Then there are optional requirements, and you might think when you've got to go buy a car, you have to know what colour it's going to be, and it must be a colour, but if you're going to do that, then there's nothing that really hangs on whether it's going to be red or white. And then there's a vast number of things which are conditional requirements, where if you want to do something, then you have to meet certain conditions. And they are all around us and they're very uncontroversial. If you want, for example, to participate at the highest level in athletics, in, say, the Olympics, then one of the conditions is you've got to be prepared to subject yourself to a medical procedure with blood testing and other things in, as part of an anti-doping regime. If you want to go on a mine site, you've got to wear occupational health and safety equipment and so on and so forth. I mean, if you want to travel to, I think I had to get, if I wanted to go to Brazil a year or so ago, I had to have a little yellow card that said that I'm being vaccinated for yellow fever. And these conditional requirements to set in place when people say, if you want to do this, then you must meet this requirement, but you don't have to do that thing at all. And of course, the overarching philosophical position on this is those requirements need to be the minimum that, you, in other words, you only have to put them in reluctantly, only when there is no real alternative or a good justification, because at least in a country like Australia, we have a presumption in favour of liberty. So you start off with that in favour of it, and then you say, what are the requirements which are strictly necessary? And those are the ones you might legitimately impose.
And this has got nothing to do, you write, with personal beliefs.
No. I mean, you might... You might, I don't know, working. I used to work in mining, and you might have somebody who's got a magical belief that somehow or other they're going to carry a talisman on their chest and it's going to keep them safe from all possible injury or causing injury to others. And a mining company will say, well, okay, you don't have to change your belief. You can believe that, but you've still got to turn up with your hard hat and your safety glasses and all the rest. And it's not an attempt to change a person's belief so much as to regulate their conduct, usually in these cases for the benefit of others and sometimes for the individual themselves, so they're available to undertake the service they offer to provide.
Now, Greg Barnes, how could you disagree with that? Because like you say you're a bit wary.
Look, I don't disagree with anything that Simon has said. My only issue and the issue that I canvassed in Pearls and Irritations was really the issue about exceptions, whether or not there can be exceptions and whether there should be exceptions. So, for example, if there are medical reasons why a person cannot have cannot be vaccinated. What does that? Where does that leave that person? The other issue is, of course, There are some groups in the community and individuals in the community who may not be able to get vaccinated because, for example, they may be itinerant, they may have genuine mental health fears around vaccination. So, and this is some of the issues that have been canvassed by some of the human rights groups, such as Liberty in the UK, that we just need to be careful that we make sure that we don't, as Simon rightly says, we don't talk about it mandatory. We talk about an educative effect for people. We talk about some tolerance, if you like, and ensuring that people who have some fear, alternatively, are not able to have the vaccine, that society is able to deal with that. So that's what I meant.
Yeah, your point. So you're in broad general agreement, but you're saying be careful. This is sort of body sovereignty is a very important thing not to be lost.
That's right. And look, I'm just finishing that. The only other point I'd make is that we tend to in Australia, and we've seen it a bit in the way in which there's been, for example, policing of COVID. We can be quite aggressive in the way we go about these campaigns. We can be quite aggressive and tend to use the law as a fairly blunt instrument. And I think that's why the federal government has been somewhat wary, because the law in this area is uncertain to this extent. Hard hats on a mine site and other requirements in the workplace are well known and well established. We're in sort of new territory here when we're talking about a vaccine. And so I think that's why there is some wary. That's not to say that there won't be some laws put in place, but we are in slightly different territory to the usual territory of adult health and safety.
Simon?
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree. I mean, this notion of bodily integrity and consent, they're all very important things, which is why my view would be that you don't necessarily say to a person at a blank level, if you're not vaccinated, then you can't work. You have an obligation as an employer to say, are there other means by which you could still discharge your service without necessarily presenting the risk? So, for example, if you could do your job perfectly well by working at home and not put at risk your fellow employees or customers or whatever, then you would want to do that. It's just that there'll be some cases, and perhaps this is in aviation, where you can't do that. And so that's when it becomes a reasonable issue. The other thing I was going to note, and I'd be really interested in Greg's view about this, Geraldine, is one of the things I think that's happened as part of this debate, and why it's, you know, the word compulsory and mandatory has been used and triggered, is I see an almost seamless flow from the days of the anti-terrorism legislation, where civil liberties started to be curbed because governments would say quite explicitly, we have no greater duty than to keep the public safe, through to today. And it's almost as if with the same language, we have no greater duty than to keep the government, the people safe. And so there's the same kind of instincts that were introduced around that national security legislation, which both aid compliance, but also perhaps mean that this whole debate is being framed in ways which is not especially helpful for a public health crisis.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting. John Watkins, for instance, wrote a piece during the week in Eureka Street about, he's the head of Catholic healthcare, and as he put it, Catholic modern medicine minimises the risk. That's what you offer. If you say to a patient, come to my hospital, and this is our compact with you, and part of that, offering that compact, which is trust, is to say to their staff who already have to be vaccinated against a range of diseases, influenza, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, hep B and so on. And this just adds to the brew. And he's saying, you know, we absolutely have to do this, otherwise we undermine our own breach with our patients. And he was actually calling for federal government help to back them up.
Geraldine, just to pick up Simon's point, and I saw they'd written something about it recently, one of the issues that we've had with anti-terror laws and the way in which they've been enforced, and you can see where it's heading here, is, and I mentioned it a moment ago, is this resort to the law and enforcement and pretty heavy-handed type of enforcement, which turns people off. So, for example, there was, I live in Tasmania, there was an article in yesterday's Hobart Mercury by a couple in their 70s who'd been terribly treated by the Tasmania Police and others when they came back into Tasmania and were told they had to quarantine despite having checked along the way. And it was a really awful story. These people in their 70s and sort of criminalised now. Now, you do not want a situation, and we saw it with anti-terror laws, where you get heavy-handed responses by government which puts law enforcement and police first when it comes to the issue of vaccines. You do not want scenes where you have people dragged off building sites or dragged out of hospitals because they don't have the vaccine. So there needs to be a very strong awareness of the sensitivities of this issue for some people, and the fact that, of course, some people may not have got the vaccine. They may unwittingly go into places, and they ought not be criminalised for doing so.
Where does John Stuart Mill, the philosopher, come into this? We haven't canvassed him yet because he's really sort of he's written the underpinning philosophy about this, hasn't he, Simon?
Well, I sort of invoked him in a gentle way at the beginning when I was talking about the presumption in favour of liberty. I mean, he's extraordinarily influential in this space, and the general proposition that Mill advances is that you should have as much liberty as is to be held, short only of when it starts to have an adverse impact on other people. And so if you want to wander around carrying a knife, which you might stab yourself with, fine, but if it's any risk of hurting someone else, that's where your right to carry the knife, for example, is limited. And so in this case, you can see exactly the same sort of formulation which is being introduced from an ethical perspective, which is, of course, we should respect, you know, your right to bodily integrity and consent and all these other things we've talked about. But when you're exercise of that right is going to have an impact on others, then they have an equal right to say, you can't harm us. And it's not as if then that you're compelled to do something. It's simply that you need to accept the consequences of the choices that you make, whether it's an apparent choice based on conscience or because of prudence or other things. And you just have to have open eyes and understand that. And that's why I've found really the whole language about compulsion and mandatory quite unhelpful, really, for people actually understanding the nature of this.
But go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to make one final point about this. The ethical significance of all this has changed radically since the introduction of vaccines. And I think one of the things we've been wrestling with as a nation, that there's been a relatively slow rollout of the vaccines. And I think, really, if you're going to insist that a person be vaccinated, and Sally McManus has made this point a number of times, you shouldn't insist on an obligation if it can't actually realistically be discharged by the person who you impose it upon. Mm-hmm. And so broad access but then maybe to vaccines
is a... Yes, but then maybe you can then insist in the absence of something like a vaccine for a range of reasons, you can insist on other behaviours. I mean, that appears to be what has brought in, because it's the urgency of this, Greg. You see, I mean, all of this has been done in super urgent times where the collective is being affected by people who are choosing without often, I think, much recognition of their impact of it, not behaving in the way they have been invited to.
I hear you. The issue, though, I think, and I know I've said it a couple of times already, but and again, it's Simon's analogy with the anti-terror laws in some ways is very good. If you have a heavy-handed approach, and an approach that uses language like mandatory and threatens sanctions and threatens fines and, you know, even possibility of, you know, something more draconian, that is not the way to get people to respond and to behave in a particular way. And if we head down the path in relation to vaccines where we criminalise people so that, in other words, if you don't have the vaccine and you do go onto a site, then suddenly you're charged with a criminal offence, that is not the way to approach it, because this is an issue which has, I think, a lot of people really grappling in their minds, as you rightly say, Geraldine, with the rapidity of it. And we need to be very careful in the way in which laws are framed so that they are sensitive, so that they encourage conduct, but they're not punitive.
You've got to be afraid of lockdowns too, don't you think, Simon? Ongoing lockdowns have their own impact too.
Well, they
which are the consequence of this, not, you know, of the invitational notion that Greg's introducing.
Well, and also they are, I mean, if we just cast our mind back to last year, where before there were vaccines, lockdowns were really the only means we had to protect ourselves. Mm. I think once the vaccines became available, the ethical significance of a lockdown changes, because you've got that. And I think part of what's happening in the Australian public around this whole thing is they're saying, particularly around lockdowns, God, if we had been vaccinated, we wouldn't be going through this. And so there's a real sense that people are saying, well, why is it that we weren't better prepared in order to deal with it? And there may be a range of reasons. I'm not looking for people to blame here. It's just simply that vaccination is a viable alternative. But that's why I think we would be far better as a nation to debate this now in that notion of conditional requirements. There's a whole range of things which you might want to do, and you're free to choose not to do them if you want. But if you do want to do them for the safety of other people, this will be applied as a condition for your doing so. And, okay, don't choose to do it if you don't, but we'll try not to impose any more than we strictly need to, but that's the basis of the way we think about it. The language we're using, which I think, as I say, is inherited from an earlier time, is unhelpful for getting a country to a point where more people say, fair enough, we can relax, we can work out how to do this as we ought to do.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Look, I thank you both very much indeed for joining us to wrestle with this. Greg Barnes from the Australian Lawyers Alliance and Dr. Simon Longstaff from the Ethics Centre.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Janet.